Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
It was open. It was transparent. It was public.
In a rare appearance at committee, NDP leader Thomas Mulcair defended his party's satellite offices in Montreal, Quebec City, and Toronto. The Conservatives and Liberals claim the New Democrats broke the rules when they sent parliamentary staff paid for by your tax dollars to work in offices operated by the party. To argue his side's point of view, we're joined by NDP House Leader Peter Julian.
Was Mulcair's testimony at committee good enough to calm this controversy? And what did we learn about how he performs under pressure? McLean's political editor Paul Wells and Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes weigh in on the McLean's panel.
12 years after Mohammed Harkat was first arrested on accusations of being an Al-Qaeda sleeper agent, the Supreme Court has upheld the government's security certificate to try and deport him to his native Algeria. To give her reaction to the ruling and talk about the next steps in this case, we're joined by Harkat's wife, Sophie.
And the Ontario election is in full swing. John Duffy, the author of Fights of Our Lives, joins us to take an interesting look at the Ontario vote and how it holds up to historic campaigns.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to the Hill.
While our opponents are wasting parliamentary resources attacking the NDP, New Democrats are using these resources to reach out to Canadians in their communities.
That's NDP leader Thomas Mulcair, who made a rare appearance before a parliamentary committee this week to defend his party's satellite offices in Montreal, Toronto, and Quebec City. In 2011, the party pooled portions of its MPs' budgets to pay for 14 parliamentary staff members. While their salaries were covered by the taxpayers, the staffers were sent to work in offices which are run and paid for by the party.
The Conservatives and Liberals accuse the NDP of using public parliamentary resources to fund partisan work, which is supposed to be kept separate. Tory MP Blake Richards claims the New Democrats broke the rules and spent millions of public dollars doing so.
The NDP has demonstrated here a very clear pattern of abuse, of taxpayers' dollars. They must take accountability, and taxpayers' money must be repaid.
But even under intense and sometimes testy questioning, Mulcair maintains his party followed the rules, dealt with House of Commons administration, and never tried to keep it hidden.
I'm not David Copperfield. I can't make an office disappear. It was open. It was transparent. It was public.
So did the NDP break the rules? To defend his party in this controversy, I'm joined by NDP House Leader Peter Julian.
I guess what is sort of the 60-second or succinct defense of what exactly you were doing there and why it wasn't against the rules or why it isn't even really worthy of concern?
Well, first off, it means actually being closer to Canadians. That's something that Ed Broadbent started when he started the first constituency office back 40 years ago. The idea is to not have all these resources concentrated in Ottawa, just speaking to lobbyists, but actually interacting with ordinary Canadians and making sure that the work that we're doing in Parliament is reflective of what people are feeling on the ground in those communities, and at the same time making sure that what we're doing in Parliament is transmitted, communicated, so that people understand what we're doing. Now, it was absolutely within the rules, and to prove that, the Conservative majority changed the rule book. They said on April 8th, no, we're not going to allow that anymore. We're going to change it. Now, they changed it with a temporary rule that's repealed automatically when the writ is dropped in the next election. And that is the best indication that both Conservatives and Liberals knew that what was being done is within the existing rule book. That's why they had to change the rule book to stop us from doing that. And we're complying with the new rules. It doesn't mean the same level of service to Canadians, but we are complying. And the reality is, because we were accepting and following the members' bylaws, they are having to go to extraordinary measures, like changing the bylaws, in order to try to throw mud and try to pretend that the NDP did something wrong.
Is there this still, though, the idea of parliamentary staff working out of an office that has political staff and has, the lease is paid for by a political party? Is that not something that could raise concerns, could get into a bit of a gray zone here where there should be some kind of harder separation between the staff that an MP has on the Hill and in their constituency and the party? Does there need to be a clearer distinction? I know you guys sort of argue that there was this separation that staff only did, parliamentary staff only did parliamentary work. But should there still be some kind of more clear, obvious, distinct separation between sort of political office and parliamentary office?
Well, there were three three clear barriers of separation. First off, there was a physical separation between the political staff. They were shut off indoors in another part of the office from the parliamentary staff. Secondly, we're talking about two different labor unions representing two different groups of staff. And having managed, in my previous life, having managed unionized enterprises, I can tell you, you want to make sure the bargaining units are doing very clear and separate work. If not, if that ever happened, there would have been a grievance, and there was never any grievance over the term of the office itself, and also very clear supervisory barriers. We're talking about two separate supervisory structures. And so there were three very clear barriers. We saved taxpayers a lot of money. It wasn't paid for through the House of Commons. It was paid for by the NDP's own funds. Now, the only part of what needed to be resolved was the issue of making sure that the parliamentary staff were doing parliamentary functions. And all of the job descriptions, all of the evidence from the hundreds of pages of information that has come to the Procedure and House Affairs points to the fact that they were only doing parliamentary work. And that's case closed. I think Tom answered all those questions at committee. Instead of attacking the official opposition, the government should actually be governing, and they should be focused on their own problems that they've caused.
People would think of parliamentary staff, though, as people that would be in say, this office or the office back in your riding. And there may be, if you get into a discussion about exactly where does the line between parliamentary work and political work, sort of where do those two things, one thing end and the other begin? And granted,
there are clear lines, very clear lines. Political work, and that is not to be done at any time by parliamentary employees, includes election campaigns. So you can't be a paid parliamentary employee while you can take a vacation, I guess, and work on an election, take leave. But if you're a parliamentary employee, you can't be working in elections, you can't be fundraising, you can't be selling membership cards. That's very clear. That's a very clear distinction. That's what's in the members' bylaws. So there's no gray area. It's very clear. And in all the accusations in the mud that the Conservatives have been throwing, and the Liberals as well, not one of them have ever come up with any example of a parliamentary employee doing non-parliamentary work. And so I think that, again, is the evidence that this is just some kind of witch hunt, some kind of mudslinging that the old parties are doing after all of their scandals. They're trying to, in some clever way, they think, attack the party that's actually been always functioning according to the rules and making sure that we keep things on the up and up.
How did you feel about I imagine you thought quite well of it, but your leader's sort of response to this. He appears before a committee, he does a couple scrums. He's fairly aggressive in rebutting the allegations or in sort of trying to rebut the allegations. Do you think your leader had a good week? Do you think that we saw something in Tom Mulcair this week?
Well, what I'm hearing from my writing is people saying, hey, finally a leader that's willing to answer questions, which Stephen Harper has never done, and of course Mr. Trudeau doesn't answer questions. He doesn't often scrum. He doesn't even ask questions in the House very often. So what they see is a leader who's actually willing to come forward and answer questions for 2 hours. I mean, this is something that a Conservative minister has never done. They do 40 minutes, maybe, at a committee, and then after that they take off. So this is the first political leader since I've been in Parliament for 10 years willing to answer questions. And that's what people see, somebody willing to answer questions. Now, he also, when somebody says something that is factually inaccurate, he doesn't have a lot of patience, and it is true that a couple of times people have tried to pretend that there wasn't a change in the members' bylaws. And when you try to pretend something that is clearly not true, I think, like most of us, we lose patience with somebody who's trying to make something up or pretend that something is true when it's not. The members' bylaws were clearly changed. Everyone admits to that. There were a couple of people that were trying to pretend it hadn't happened. But I think now, with the course of the week, because there's been a lot more evidence brought forward and people have read through hundreds of pages of documents, people are seeing. The NDP had a long communication over months and months with the House administration, with the clerk's office, got sign-off from the clerk on the pooled staffing. I was always clear about the Montreal office and making sure that pay and benefits and the House finance were in the loop. And we even held a press conference to kick off the office. So I think people are seeing now that it was really an attempt by the Conservatives to try to turn the channel away from their own scandals.
How, though, was he almost too aggressive? I mean, he was a bit sarcastic. He was a bit condescending yesterday, dealing with questions. You know, should he have toned it down a bit? Should he have been a bit more humble in facing that committee? You know, would you have accepted sort of that response, that kind of tough response from Mr. Harper or a cabinet minister in that situation?
Oh, I've seen cabinet ministers, and they have been brutal and personally insulting. I think he made a couple of quips, two or three quips. I saw it as a very open presentation of the arguments, making sure people were led through the appropriate arguments. When there was a stupid question, yeah, as I say, sometimes in all of our cases, when somebody says something that is factually untrue, he called them on it.
That was NDP House Leader Peter Julian.
It's time now for the Maclean's panel, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Aaron Wary, as well as Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes and political editor Paul Wells. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, we're talking about Mulcair's committee appearance this week, as well as this whole satellite office issue. We'll start off with you, Aaron, because you were in the committee room watching this all happen as Mulcair faced off against Conservative and Liberal MPs. How did Mulcair perform?
Well, he was certainly aggressive and feisty about it. You know, the knock on Mr. Mulcair from Liberals and Conservatives is that he's Angry Tom. This is the label they want to pin on him. And I don't think you actually saw any of that yesterday. He never really got angry, but he certainly came ready for a fight, and he certainly was more than happy to engage in a fight about things. He was a bit snarky. He was a bit sarcastic. He was a bit condescending. You know, he came back at the Conservatives and Liberals as hard as they came at him. So I think it'll be interesting to see sort of how that plays and whether, you know, if the public sort of was following this issue, what they thought of how he responded. It's not necessarily what we are used to sort of seeing from somebody who's in a position of trouble. He wasn't, you know, just repeating talking points. He wasn't trying to sort of be docile and try to get out of this as easily as possible. He was ready for a fight. I thought it was, you know, regardless of sort of the underlying controversy of the issue, I thought it was a really interesting performance.
John, did he actually do enough to put this matter to rest, to get rid of the criticism and stop everything that's been going on? Or is this going to drag on because there are still a lot of unanswered questions?
I think it'll drag on for those of us who follow things on Parliament Hill. But this really, I mean, there's sort of a cliche about things being in the bubble, right? And I don't like to trade in that too much. But this really is in the bubble. It has to do with administrative rules on Parliament Hill. You know, the difference between a political operation and a parliamentary operation. These are things the average Canadian is not going to focus on. So, like, getting back to the kinds of things Aaron was touching on, what we see is a story that is now just sort of underscored the persona of Mulcair as a parliamentarian, a guy who lives and works and fights around Parliament Hill. And the interesting contrast here is not so much he and Stephen Harper, it's he and Justin Trudeau. You know, Justin Trudeau and the Liberals are really not very important in this battle. It's mostly, I know they've been active on the file, but it's mostly a Tories versus NDP battle. And it just reminds us that there's a leader here who's sort of seems to want to be thought of as a guy of the House, a guy of Parliament, and that's Mulcair. And then there's the other opposition leader who's really, that's not his thing. So to the degree that we're crystallizing anything out that would matter to Canadians who don't want to follow the nuances of House administrative rules, that's, I think, the lesson that's coming out of this.
So, Paul, what did you think of Mulcair's performance? And then also to touch on what John was talking about, do Canadians really care, or should they even care about this story?
Well, Canadians should always be interested in questions of whether parliamentary resources are being well and properly used. And I'm afraid I can tell them that at the end of this week, the answer is hard to say. Meanwhile, for those who follow these things closely here on the Hill, Mulcair slammed two cards down on the table quite hard this week. First one was smartest guy in the room. If you're in that minority of voters who are just attracted to the guy with the most book learning, there's not a lot of competition left for Tom Mulcair. It was ridiculous. He was punning in Latin. He was offering people autographed copies of a legal text that he wrote in French 33 years ago. It was a virtuoso display of intellectual wankery of the highest order, and it was actually quite impressive. The other card he put on the table was he doesn't have the faintest intention of getting rolled over in a polarized race between Stephen Harper and Justin Trudeau. If the Trudeau mania bus wants to roll over Tom Mulcair, he served notice this week that he will bite off its tires. He said in so many words that he will never hesitate to use the same tactics that the Conservative government used on its way to becoming the Conservative government. He's clearly interested in pushing parliamentary resources as far forward into the field as he can and dealing with the consequences later. Those highly tendentious mailers that the New Democrats spent a decade complaining about when other parties sent them, the New Democrats are now sending them in bulk whenever they can. This is a guy who wants to fight.
Can I say something, Paul? You pick up that idea of him not wanting to be rolled over. He's not going to allow this to be a Harper-Trudeau dynamic. NDPers here on the Hill have to be looking, well, I know they're looking hard at the Ontario election right now, and there is a danger there of Andrea Horvath and the provincial NDP being sort of marginalized in what looks like a Liberal-Conservative battle. And this has to be firming up in the minds of New Democrats at the federal level what the big danger is for them. And I agree with you. It's really hard to see Mulcair as a guy who's going to easily be forgotten about in any kind of a robust battle.
There's also, even just on the, if you take it sort of, and you assume that there's some percentage, maybe 60%, who might not want to vote Conservative, they end up with a choice. They can go with the hope and vision of Justin Trudeau and the fresh-faced newness of it, or they can go with now Thomas Mulcair, who's a tough fighter. And I think New Democrats like that in their guy. They like a certain amount of toughness and fight to it. So you do the comparison, you go, okay, well, where did Jack Layton, how did he get to where he was? Well, he somehow managed to, I think, bridge the divide between, sweetness and light and toughness. So you kind of wonder how big the support could possibly be for somebody who's fighting all the time. But to a certain degree, I think the New Democrats probably come out of this week thinking, our guy showed that he's a fighter and that he's tough and that he's smart. And I suspect they come out feeling at least, fairly happy with that.
Now, just a little bit more on the topic itself of the satellite office issue. Part of the defense from Mulcair is that this is a party office with parliamentary staff working inside of it, and the work between the two never mixed at all. I mean, how plausible is that defense when you really think about it?
It's at least plausible until somebody can prove that that's not what was happening. So what you have here is a situation where, in theory, MPs should be only hiring staff to either work in their parliamentary office on the Hill or their constituency office back in the riding. And what the NDP did was pool some of the resources from those parliamentary budgets to put staff in a single office in Montreal that was leased by the party and also had party staff in it. Now, the NDP claims there was this, division of church and state, and that political staff did political work and parliamentary staff did parliamentary work. First of all, it's we can get into a very long discussion about how you ever divide parliamentary and political work. And it's not clear that, how exactly the rules should be applied in this case. The NDP has ended up falling back on this argument that, well, since a new rule was introduced to expressly prohibit what we were doing, that must mean that before that rule was introduced, what we were doing was fine. It's a fascinating legal argument, and we'll see how far it goes. I suspect they have at least gotten to a point this week where they have at least undermined the controversy to a certain degree. We'll see what happens. The committee still wants to study this. The clerk of the House of Commons will be called. There will be more questions asked, but they have at least muddled the issue just enough that what might have seemed like a very big controversy, I think, earlier in the week, now seems just murky enough that, you can maybe forgive it, or not, maybe not forgive it, but at least sort of let it go a bit.
Paul, do you want to jump in on this?
It's hard to overstate how arcane this all is, although I suspect a lot of folks listening at home are way ahead of us in reaching that conclusion. The interesting thing is, when this whole system was being set up, we were nearly 4 years away from the next federal election. The NDP party was going through, a wrenching adjustment from having gotten into a official opposition status, the sudden death of Jack Layton, a leadership race, and all along it was making, almost from sort of muscle memory and instinct, a bunch of decisions that have to do with holding gains and making further gains in the next election. This is not your sort of mom and pop shop NDP of the 70s and 80s. It is a kind of scary organization, unless you're a New Democrat, in which case I agree with Aaron, but I would go even further. They spent all week being told that Tom Mulcair would take a pasting on Thursday, and they reached the weekend thinking that they probably won the week.
I'm just thinking about that, Cormac, the idea that the NDP is a serious operation. A little aside here, Anne McGrath returned in April and sort of getting set up again as national director. This is a familiar face from the Jack Layton era. This is a party that has real experience, you know, like serious people, real experience working in it. And that's something that you could argue that even the Harper Conservatives, just given the churn and turnover in Stephen Harper's operation, maybe doesn't have as much muscle memory about elections as the NDP does right now.
All right, thank you very much, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, political editor Paul Wells, and my co-host Aaron Wherry. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Coming up, we speak with the wife of accused terror suspect Mohammed Harkat about this week's major Supreme Court ruling, and we take a historical look at the Ontario election.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we take an historical look at the election underway in Ontario, and we give you a rundown of the four federal by-elections announced by Prime Minister Stephen Harper. But first, the Supreme Court released a major decision this week.
Our country's top judges handed down a ruling on Wednesday upholding the National Security Certificate against terror suspect Mohammed Harkat, opening the door to his possible deportation. Harkat was an Ottawa pizza delivery man and gas station attendant who was arrested in 2002 on allegations he was a sleeper agent for Al-Qaeda.
He was held in custody for 4 years before being released on strict bail conditions. Since then, he has challenged the security certificate program in court, claiming he is innocent and was never allowed to see the evidence against him. The government has said some of the evidence is a matter of national security. In the 67-page ruling, the judges were unanimous in saying the process was fair and constitutional, and that the decision to find Harkat inadmissible to Canada was reasonable.
A day later, Harkat addressed the media.
I was expecting a fair and open trial. So the ultimate goal yesterday, it's shattered. That's all 12 years of waiting for the highest court in the land to give me a fair and open trial to defend myself. So basically, what's left now, if the government of Canada want to send me to Algeria, it's they have to send me with a box. They're going to torch me and bury me on it.
Some strong words, with Harkat saying he'll need a casket if he's deported back to Algeria because he'll be killed.
To talk more about the ruling and what happens next, I'm joined now by Sophie, the wife of Mohammed Harkat.
Thank you for having me.
My first question will be just to have you take us back to that moment on Wednesday. You arrived early in the Supreme Court to get a briefing with your lawyer before the ruling was made public. What was the feeling like when you finally got the news that the judgment didn't go your way?
Well, what had happened back in 2007 when the first Supreme Court ruling came out, we were actually all in the hallway waiting for the lawyers to come down and the media to come down at the same time. I didn't feel like it was a proper way for us to learn of our decision out in front of everybody. So this time we had asked for a private room where we could meet with counsel privately right after the decision. And when they came down, you could see it in their faces immediately that something had gone wrong. I said, come on, you must have gotten something. And he said, no, the whole thing was overturned. Never in a million years do we expect that kind of outcome. It was shocking. It wasn't a slap in the face, it was a punch in the face.
How did it feel? What was the scene like in that room? How upset were you and your husband, Mohammed?
I was so upset myself that I tear up quite easily, and I couldn't even tear up. I was so angry. I don't know who to be angry at. Was I angry at the Supreme Court? Was I angry at my country? Was I angry because I didn't do enough? I didn't know who I was angry at. I think, honestly, I was more angry at my whole country for putting me through this process and for the unfairness and the secrecy behind it. I felt somewhat betrayed.
Why do you feel betrayed by your country?
Betrayed in the sense that we have a democracy here, and we're known in Canada for human rights and due process. And I felt like the secrecy around security certificates, well, doesn't apply to immigrants and refugees. They treat them as second-class citizens. We've always wanted to have a fair and open trial. We've never been afraid of having the evidence out in public. We were asked yesterday, would you want to see the evidence? And we said, yes. Yes, we want to see the whole thing. That's how sure we are of the evidence. You know, well, we say evidence, but everything has been destroyed. I mean, there's no original material that exists. If it was a criminal case, the whole case would fall apart if just one piece of evidence was destroyed. Now we're talking about an entire case. But and in that sense, I felt betrayed in the sense that he didn't get a fair trial. And I thought my country would give him that. Like, I thought my country would treat him equally and fairly.
So in the Supreme Court ruling, they address the fact that it is difficult to try and balance national security concerns with fair and due process in our country. But they still felt like the process for your husband, Mohammed, was fair and was reasonable. They looked over all of the issues, and the lower court's ruling has been upheld.
Right. In a sense of national security, I agree there should be laws in place to protect Canadians. We need to strike a balance between justice and security. I totally agree with that. But for example, when the special advocates were put in place, they were put in place to, we thought, cross-examine secret information in secret, where no one would know, would be able to identify the informant. No one would know his name. No one would see his face. So he would be protected totally. So I don't know why the special advocates never had access to the informants. Now, they also said that there was an exceptional circumstance clause, for example. In her case, why didn't that clause apply when the informant failed the lie detector test? Now, we know for a fact that that informant itself is the link to the majority of the allegations against my husband. And unfortunately, we think it's someone that my husband has known, that I knew myself, that is also known to have maybe provide information in other cases. To us, that is a serious concern. I mean, our advocate, when we put him in place, we said, you cross-examine information about this informant because we need to get to the bottom. And the special advocate didn't get that chance. So in that sense, I mean, why – there's no way national security would have been affected if that would have happened.
In the ruling, they do address that. They say there are those special circumstances where the judges need to use their discretion to say whether there should be a cross-examination, whether that's needed. But in this case specifically, the Supreme Court ruled that, no, it wasn't needed. And I mean, I'm not privy, and
well,
neither are you, to all the
Noel.
Evidence to know.
They agreed with Noel, but we always thought that Noel should have given access. We always thought that Noel should have given access to the special advocates, to the informant and the other human sources that he also said, no, it's not necessary.
In the Supreme Court ruling, as we mentioned, it upheld a ruling that the security certificate against your husband was reasonable. And in that security certificate, it alleges that your husband has terrorist links, that he may have abetted terrorists at a home in Pakistan, and that he may be an Al-Qaeda sleeper agent. When the top court in our country upholds something like that and those allegations, do you personally ever have doubts of your husband's innocence?
No, but that's not the important thing. The important thing is about due process.
But, I mean, personally, on a personal level, aside from the specifics of the case, you don't have any doubts about the innocence of your husband. You still have faith in
yes.
His claims.
Yes, I do. I've sat with him. We've had discussion. I've been in meetings with special advocates before. He did meet with some people himself that during his testimony admitted are fishy, but doesn't make him a terrorist to be in connection or know people. I mean, if you shake someone's hand and you met him once, it doesn't make you a terrorist. Like I said, anybody, I give sometimes talks and I say, well, now you're all associated to me. I'm the wife of Mohammed Arkat. You're attending my lecture. Now you're associated to me. It's by associations, by hearsay, by information you get from somebody else, from a third party, from an informant. All that needs to be questioned.
Can I ask you a little bit about the process moving forward now? Have you been contacted at all yet by Canada Border Services Agency or the government about the deportation order, which now stands after the Supreme Court ruling?
No, we haven't been contacted yet. There's a government immigration officer that has to go over what risk my husband faces if he goes back to Algeria versus what risk Canadians face if he stays in this country. And the Supreme Court did say that my husband is basically not as much of a threat as he was to, and very, very slim threat in this country. I mean, he barely has any conditions left, and over the time, he's a very well-known person. But my position has been the same from the beginning. He's never been a threat to start with.
So moving forward, you're obviously going to fight the risk assessment, and yourself and your husband have claimed that if he goes back to Algeria, he will be tortured and possibly killed. And we heard earlier in the show the clip where he said that they would have to send a casket along with him. Mm-hmm. What proof do you have that he may be tortured if he's headed back to Algeria? Do you know for a fact that he may be imprisoned if he steps foot back in his native country?
Yes, there was a case of an Algerian that was deported before him back in the early 2000s under a security certificate. He was detained in a secret prison. His family didn't know where he was for a long period of time. I mean, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch do have concrete reports that prove that individuals are tortured in Algeria. They have evidence of that. There's not a democracy in Algeria. There's not, he probably wouldn't get a trial. He will definitely be detained, tortured, and I don't even want to think of, because he's labeled. I mean, the reality is he's been labeled by this government.
So what happens then? I mean, if you do win your appeal on the risk assessment factor that he shouldn't be deported back to Algeria, in the eyes of the government, he will always be a security threat to this country. And if that's the case, how do you move forward with that? I mean, have your lawyers talked to you? Would he just remain under bail conditions for the rest of his life? Would he be detained by the government again? What are the options there moving forward?
I really don't know. This is a really hard question. For example, if you look at Mr. Suresh, he was fighting deportation for, I think his lawyer said, almost 20 years. And he just, like, a couple years ago got away with his conditions. But he was monitored one way or another. My husband is a very public figure, so people, you know, keep an eye on that as well. And I'm sure we'll be monitored one way or another. But the other point that's also important is to keep in here, to keep him alive. I mean, that's his home. We don't want him to go anywhere else. I'm sure we will never have a normal life.
He's a security threat in the eyes of the government.
Yeah.
And the chance to appeal that has gone all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they have ruled in favor of the government side. So on the face value of it, he doesn't have a chance to clear his name anymore at this point. How does that feel for you and your husband, knowing that that option has been taken away?
Well, we know the truth, and the people that love him know the truth. That's important. We just want to go on and live normal lives and do what's the best that we can. I mean, we know it's never going to be the same.
That was Sophie Harcourt, the wife of Mohammed Harcourt, who was accused of being an Al-Qaeda sleeper agent. We invited Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney on the show to talk about this case, but his office declined, pointing us to a statement that says the government is pleased with the Supreme Court's decision.
Coming up, we take a look at the Ontario election and how the party leaders compare to some of history's best campaigners.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Well, it's time to take a look at elections across the country. We'll start off with federal by-elections. At the end of last week, Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced that on June 30th, by-elections would be held for four of the five vacant seats in the House of Commons, two in Alberta and two in Toronto.
In the West, the seats up for grabs are in the ridings of McLeod and Fort McMurray, Athabasca. And in our country's largest city, the open ridings are in Trinity, Spadina, and Scarborough Agincourt. Those last two ridings became available when two MPs decided to quit the House of Commons and take a run at municipal politics. Olivia Chow is trying to become mayor of Toronto, and Jim Karagiannis is running to be a city councillor.
Now, the Alberta seats are expected to be easy wins for the Conservatives, but the Toronto seats will be the real battles. Historically, Trinity Spadina has flipped back and forth between the New Democrats and the Liberals. While the NDP hope to hang on, the Grits have recruited a star candidate in former City Councillor Adam Vaughan. In Scarborough Agincourt, the Liberals have held the seat since it was formed in 1988. In the last election, the Conservatives posted some gains and are hoping to upset the Grits to build momentum ahead of the 2015 general vote. Now, the PM has not yet called a by-election for Whitby Oshawa, the seat left vacant following the death of former Finance Minister Jim Flaherty.
We move now from federal to provincial campaigns. Before we get to the election in Ontario, we want to give you an update on the race to replace Alison Redford as Premier of Alberta. This week, former Conservative Cabinet Minister Jim Prentice picked up his nomination papers to run as a candidate in the PC leadership contest, and early predictions say it will be a landslide victory for him. MLA Rick McIver is the only other candidate to grab his nomination papers so far. There were several people who had announced they wanted to run, but once they heard Prentice's name, they backed down and threw their support behind him. Whoever wins this race will automatically become Premier of the province.
And now we turn to the Ontario election, which is approaching the midway point of the campaign. It's been an interesting battle so far, with polls showing some mixed results, although the trend is clear. It's a three-way race. The Kathleen Wynne Liberals and Tim Hudak PCs are fighting for the top spot, while the New Democrats, under the leadership of Andrea Horvath, trail not too far behind. Instead of just recapping the week that was in this campaign, we thought it would be interesting to look at the election from an historical context.
John Duffy is a founder of the public affairs consulting firm Strategy Corps and is an expert on the history of Canadian election campaigns. He wrote the book Fights of Our Lives, which is an essential reference for political animals of all stripes. Full disclosure, in the past, Duffy has been an advisor to many prominent Liberals, including Kathleen Wynne, but he is not working for her now. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with Duffy over the phone to consider how this race in Ontario might echo past campaigns.
Let me start by asking you about the guy who's, I would say, is dominating so far. Conservative leader Tim Hudak. He's lost once before. He's getting a second chance. Are there previous campaigns or examples of leaders who showed how this kind of trick can be done, people who came back from an early defeat and regrouped for their next campaign?
Well, many leaders, certainly, John, in the history of Ontario, lose a first campaign and then get better and win. That's what Mr. Hudak is seeking to replicate. That pattern is not as prevalent at the federal level in our history, and in other provinces, not quite as prevalent. But in some respects, what Mr. Hudak is trying to do really resembles something that, you mentioned how his policy offering is really proving to be the principal theme of the campaign to date. This kind of move, which I see as a leader saying, I'm going to talk about what I want to talk about, and it might not be what everybody likes, but damn it, I think it's important. We've seen that sometimes. The most reminiscent occasion I can think of is Pierre Trudeau in 1979. Saying, look, I don't care what my advisors say. I'm going to talk about the Constitution because I think that's what's important for Canada. And in Hudak's case, I think he's taking a similar damn the torpedoes approach. Didn't work for Trudeau. He wound up losing. And we'll see if it works for Hudak.
That's interesting. Now, how about Kathleen Wynne? She's come into a role in the wake of quite a messy exit by her predecessor, right? I mean, she's got to somehow get over the hump of the way that Dalton McGuinty went down and kind of, I guess, somewhat unhitch yourself from that legacy, create a different persona. Are there other people, past leaders, you think have pulled off that trick, or are there examples of where it didn't work that way?
Sure. Well, at the federal level, the scenario of having an unpopular leader exit and a new leader seek to successfully extend a party's time in office has been tried a lot of times. It's actually almost as common to have that happen as a way to change prime ministers as it is to actually have parties change in an election. So it's a play that happens a lot at the federal level, and it actually doesn't usually work at the federal level. most of the time you have a Kim Campbell or a John Turner or an Arthur Meehan to go back a bit of a ways, or an Abbott Thompson, Ball, and Tupper to go back all the way to the 1890s.
Right.
People who unsuccessfully seek to extend their party's rule by offering a change of leadership. Sometimes, however, it works at the federal level, most notably the transition from Lester Pearson to Pierre Trudeau. It kind of worked for a while, the transition from John Chrétien to Paul Martin. In Ontario, it is a less, or excuse me, it is a much more successful play. Extending party terms in office through change of leadership, in fact, was the hallmark of a 42-year dynasty by the provincial Progressive Conservatives. They went from George Drew to T.L. Kennedy to Leslie Frost to John Robarts to Bill Davis. The dynasty just kept going, and leaders would change, but the party would stay in office. So that's the vein in which Kathleen Wynne is trying to carry on. Now, each time when you try to do this, increasingly in the modern world, you have to be different from your predecessor. It was very important. I think it will be very important, for example, for whoever's the next leader of the Alberta Progressive Conservative Party to come across very different from Alison Redford. Hmm. I think it's obviously been very important for Kathleen Wynne to offer a different kind of Liberal government from that of her predecessor's late era, that of Dalton McGuinty's. And I think she's definitely created the impression of a different Liberal offering. I don't think there's much doubt about that to date.
John, can I go back to something you said a minute ago about Hudak running on a sort of, here's what I want to talk about, taking the risk of putting a lot out there. Does that remind you at all of, I'm thinking about the famous Common Sense Revolution platform of Harris, or at the federal level, the Red Book platform of Chrétien at the start? Does it smack of those approaches to you?
Certainly not the Red Book. And the Red Book was a document that was intended to reflect. Actually, I did some work on the Red Book way back when.
Yeah.
And the Red Book was an attempt to, I think, crystallize an emerging consensus that was there in the country about which way to go forward. It was definitely a centrist document that was supposed to promote a wide degree of consensus.
As opposed to sort of provoking people or breaking new ground.
Hudak's plan is much more like the Common Sense Revolution. And in fact, there's a lot of newspaper commentators and reporters, including the Augusta editorial board of the Toronto Globe and Mail. This is a much more aggressive prescription for radically changing Ontario's government and economy than even the Common Sense Revolution. It actually, by most objective standards, involves cutting government's role at a pace about twice as fast and twice as deep as that of Harris. So there's not a lot of precedence for this kind of thing.
Right.
But if it reminds anybody of anything, it reminds them of the Common Sense Revolution. Yeah, you're right on that.
John, I don't want to ignore the NDP and Andrea Horvath entirely here. There's a couple ways of thinking about her. Like, one is to look at her from Wynne's perspective. If Wynne is thinking about how to counter Hudak, she has to also be thinking, I guess, of pushing down that NDP vote to give the Liberals more of the center-left and left share of the Does that remind you of any past campaigns, the sort of triangulation issues there?
Well, sure. I mean, the Liberals want things to look like 1972, 1974, where Trudeau's government positioned itself somewhat more on the progressive side than it had been, and was able to compress the NDP vote and in the 1974 election attract a lot of votes from the New Democrats and use that to take them over the top into a solid majority in 1974. That's deeply embedded in the muscle memory of Liberals as a wonderful scenario. Something similar happened for the Liberals, in fact, in the mid-1940s when Mackenzie King largely co-opted the new welfare state ideas that had been being pushed by the CCF and parlayed them into great big wins for the Liberals as the war wound down and the erection of the post-war welfare state occurred. So this is the kind of historical resonance that these sorts of maneuvers have for Liberals. For the NDP, the interesting thing is that they're not satisfied with playing the role of useful idea maker to Liberal governments.
Right.
A lot of what's been happening in the NDP, particularly since the rise of the late Jack Layton, has been shaking off that role and saying, no, we don't want that job. We want to be government. And in order to do that, we're going to change what we're offering. And so the NDP is offering an emphasis on pocketbook issues and, in fact, arguing for government restraint, which has many long-time New Democrat commentators saying, what's happened to the NDP? Have they lost their soul? One commentator, Rick Salutin in the Toronto Star, who's been a lifelong progressive left-winger, says that what Andrea Horvath is now offering is, quote, right-wing populism, end quote. So there's a lot of action going on the left side of the spectrum as well. It's an interesting election.
It is. And I was going to ask you a very broad question. To me, this looks like the kind of election that has all the factors, right? Very interesting leaders, very interesting policy, really clear definition. Not a lot of sort of empty days, right? The campaign has had a lot of days packed full of news. So are you thinking this one looks like like one for the ages?
Well, I think it is in this sense. So I'm in the capital of Ontario right now, which is downtown Toronto, and there are a lot of trucks going by. There's one for the beer store, which was going to be an issue, but then Mr. Hudak said it won't be.
Right.
All kidding aside, I think it will be because, in a lot of ways, the values clash is so basic here. There's something very elemental about Mr. Hudak's offering of a very programmatic, very hard right-wing doctrine, and a very, pretty serious shock treatment for the Ontario government and economy. That clash between that worldview that says we have to cut and get small and that's our way back to prosperity is lined up against the win view, which is we need to make dramatic investments in things like infrastructure, transportation, public transit, roads and bridges, as well as an Ontario pension plan. So you really have investment-oriented liberalism up against cut-oriented conservatism in a very elemental clash in this election. It's going to be fascinating to see which emerges in the winner's circle on the 12th of June.
John, thanks a lot for sketching it in this nice historic context for it. Really appreciate that.
A pleasure.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking about the Ontario election with John Duffy, the author of Fights of Our Lives.
That's it for this week's episode.
Thank you to NDP House Leader Peter Julian, Sophie Harcotte, and author John Duffy.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.